I'm very delighted for Jeff to be up here tonight.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Jeff, and I am an alcoholic and an addict. We'll go ahead and get that part out of the way right now. There are drugs in my story. There's also a lot of alcohol in my story. So there has been times in my life. One thing about sharing in a meeting and you're sitting down in chairs, people around you and your mind goes blank. And you can just say, thanks for letting me share. And everybody just forgets about it. Up here in front of 100 people staring at me, that's not going to happen. So I wrote all this stuff down. So fortunately, I can get by through some of it. My sobriety date is January 24th to 2023. My home group is the Rule 62 group at 8111. Thank you. Where's Bo when you need him? We meet Monday, Thursday, and Saturday night at 8 o'clock. If you've never been there, I would highly recommend you come. It's a big group. We have a lot of fun. There's a lot of recovery. There's a lot of long-term sobriety there. It's a great place. And, you know, as the name says, we definitely don't take ourselves too seriously there. That's what Rule 62 means, if you didn't know. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. And cool, both of them are here today, and that's pretty cool. And I also sponsor some men as well. Easter greetings to everyone. Hope everybody had a good day yesterday. You know, the singleness of purpose behind me says freedom from recovery from alcoholism. There have been times in my life where my life became very, very unmanageable because of alcohol. And there's also a lot of other, I call them kind of, in a way, I call them side dishes. There's other side dishes that have been thrown in there too. That's really what made my life very unmanageable. But there are many times where I did a lot of drinking, and that led me to some other things. And so that was a gateway for me for a lot of other stuff. You know, there's an old friend of mine. He used to come to this building a lot. Some of the old guys may know him. I talked to him today. His name is Harry. And I talked to Harry today. Tim, of course, you knew him very well. And Harry said something to me many years ago. We've known each other over 35 years. He's been 35 years sober, and we used to drink and use together. Does that give you an idea how long I knew him? One of the times we were out, I was at his house, and the way he drank, he would actually get a bottle of Wild Turkey, tip it upside down, bubbles going up in the bottle, just like you see on TV. And he'd chase it with Budweiser. That's how we drank. And it was pretty hardcore. And he told me, he said, Jeff, I'm so grateful for crack cocaine. Because crack cocaine brought me into the rooms of AA a lot sooner than Wild Turkey would have all by itself. That's very true. And I can say that from my own past. You know, that brought me to my knees a lot quicker than just drinking. I remember the night distinctly. We're at his house watching an NFL game on a, you know, he was one of the first ones to have like a 55-inch TV in his big game room. And it was just cool as could be seeing that thing. And he was chugging down his Wild Turkey, and he passed me the bottle, and I hit it, and I about just lost it right there. I mean, Wild Turkey 101 bites on the way down, believe me. And I asked him, I said, Harry, don't you have any of that Canadian whiskey that's a lot smoother? And he said, no, I don't. Well, just give me a Budweiser. So I drank a bunch of Budweisers. So Harry, I have a lot more stories about Harry. I can also say that, you know, the first step, we admit we're powerless over alcohol. I like to say I was powerless over my addiction, more so than just alcohol. Because, you know, I've tried everything you can imagine. I've tried one time. Everything. Everything that can change the way I felt, I've tried it once. And the things I really liked, I kept doing them. It's kind of easier for me to understand that about the first step, about my level of powerlessness and how certain things make my life very, very unmanageable. Right now, I am right where I'm supposed to be, standing here in front, you know, talking to y'all tonight. It all began in Houston, Texas in 1961 when I was born. My mom and dad, very loving parents. They were married over 50 years. My mom was a school teacher. My dad was a finance executive. And we grew up under fairly fortunate circumstances, I would think. Grew up in Houston with my mother's family, who's all Lebanese immigrants. Mother was born in right outside Beirut. And grew up with the under the eye and protection of my grandparents. And it was a very, very good upbringing. Dad got transferred to a few places. I have an older brother, 2 years older than myself. You know, Dad would get transferred around Texas a little bit. And we were living in Dallas. And in 1973, right before I turned 12 years old, Dad got transferred here to Atlanta. And in the early mid-70s, and grew up in Dunwoody. And back then, growing up in Dunwoody in the 70s was a pretty cool place to grow up. We were kind of in a bubble. It was a difficult time for somebody my age and my brother's age to move to a new city when we're used to being around our family all the time and try to make friends and just try to get accepted by anybody that would accept us. And sometimes that's not a good thing. We're very desperate to try to be accepted. Sometimes we get accepted by maybe the wrong sort of folks. And here it was, the early mid-70s. And back then, before I ever took a drink of liquor, I started smoking weed. And that was a pretty normal thing, I guess, for a lot of us back then at that time. When I was 14 years old, we went to high school. And back then, 8th through 12th grade was high school. There was no middle school. So we went literally from being the kings of elementary school to the peons of high school in one summer. It was interesting. You know, I had an older brother. And the first time I ever remember really drinking was a friend of mine in my neighborhood. His parents were out for the night. And they had a big game room with a big bar. And we were practicing being bartenders that night, him and I. I got so sick, I blacked out, threw up, and it was awful. But I remember partly a little bit before the blackout part that I remember how good it felt. And that didn't last that long. Then I threw up. It was an awful night. It was so awful, I did it the next weekend. And the weekend after that, and the weekend after that. And mixing in some other things along the way. Growing up at that time, where I was going to school, almost everybody was doing something, and that's just the way it was. I was a classic underachiever as far as a student. My mom was a school teacher, history teacher. She taught high school back when we were growing up, and I was always fairly well read, especially with social type studies, with history and so forth. And being the classic underachiever, I was a guy that hardly ever did homework. Showed up for class half the time, showed up on test days, ace tests, and I always made B's and C's by acing tests because I was never hardly there. And it was just what I did. And I forgot I left this very important part out. When we first moved here from Texas, we're trying so hard to be accepted by other kids. And there was these seven words, and Max knows what these seven words, I've shared this a lot of times. These seven words would pop in my head. And these seven words was, don't these people know who I am? And those seven words were in my head for a long, long time. Sometimes it brought comfort, sometimes it did not. But more often than not, it just separated me and had my character defects. All these character defects that I had no idea what a character defect was in. All I know is I liked more of everything I liked. It didn't matter. I wanted the biggest piece of birthday cake. It didn't matter. I wanted the biggest of everything. That's just the way I was. I wanted more. I was addicted to more. Keg parties on the weekends. I was a good athlete. I always had a really good skill with certain things. Hung out keg parties on the weekends. We did this every single weekend. We did a lot of drinking. And you know what? Withdrawals or anything like that really hadn't happened to any of us, as far as I knew. But we, as I say, there was no hard stuff outside of weed and alcohol was evident at that time. Graduated high school in 79. Went to DeKalb College North Campus. And Dunwoody right down the street. It was like going to 13th grade. A lot of us were going there from high school straight to there. Now it went to Georgia Primber. Now it's a branch of Georgia State, right at Womack and Tilly Mill Road in Dunwoody. And went there for 2 years. continued doing a lot of drinking, a lot of partying, and in my second year there is when I was introduced to some white stuff. And I knew almost instantly that this was it. This was different than everything else. And it really, really set the tone for a lot of behavior and problems down the road. Along with my drinking and along with everything else, I started bartending in Atlanta. I first started around 82, and I bartended in some pretty wild places. And back then, Atlanta was a wild place to be, going downtown, going to the bars. Some of the wilder bars didn't even open until 2 a.m. That's when they opened, you know, and close. I mean, I was a bartender at Lenny's on Peace Industrial Boulevard. Some of the old guys may remember that place. And we closed at 4 a.m., seven nights a week, 4 a.m. Didn't matter, Sunday night, didn't care, 4 a.m. We'll get out of there at 5, and that's when the night began. And we would go downtown, and we'd go to crazy places. And, you know, the word is back then, when you're walking into one of these bars at night, take your sunglasses with you. Because you're leaving when the sun's out. And, you know, it was a really, really crazy existence for probably about three and a half years. And I'll talk about my dad for a minute. My dad was an alcoholic as well. He went to his first AA meeting at the Biscayne Room in 1980. Maggie gave him his white chip. And there's people in this room right now that knew who Maggie was. Gave my dad his white chip in 1980. And I had already moved out of the house, my second year of college when I moved out. And shared a house with four buddies of mine. It was crazy. I'm sure they made many a movie about that these days, but I lived the real thing back then. And my dad was worried about his youngest son, me. My brother was already on his way playing music. He was a musician traveling around. He was doing his own thing. I was kind of rudderless, doing crazy stuff. I remember I would come to my parents' house for Sunday dinner many a Sunday. And I remember Dad was, I remember it because I was debating on not going that Sunday because I felt awful. I don't think I slept for two or three days, and I still went. And my dad, he knew something was really wrong, pulled me to the side, and we talked. And, you know, I guess I might have been a pet project of his, you know. He has about 4 years sober at this time. And my dad was really, really involved in AA. I had known a long time ago that this program worked. He saved my dad's life. I knew it worked. When I was 23 years old, I didn't care. I mean, I was having fun, man. I didn't care. But I listened. My dad was a very smart man. I listened to my dad. In 1985, I was still another year from doing what he wanted me to do. I wasn't done. Sowing the oats, whatever you want to call it. I wasn't done yet. The behaviors and, you know, at this point in time, I've had no legal consequences whatsoever. That came quite a few years later. And I'll get to that. In 1985, I was bartending, and I still also, not far as drinking a lot and smoking a lot of stuff. I used to sell a little bit of stuff too here and there. I came really close one time to being caught up in a large operation by DEA. I'm going to details, but I was kind of lucky not to be rounded up. I happened to leave at a certain place at a certain amount of time. And that's happened to me a few other times in my life much later on. I don't know if it was psychic, having a sixth sense, I don't know. I thought I had one of my friends went down for quite a long time, and it was his third time getting caught trafficking. I remember he went to Jackson. I never saw him again. And when I came back years later after the military, he was still gone. And I ran into some other friends of mine. I just realized that I think that might have been the first time I ever had a moment of clarity in my life. I've had a few other times as well since then. The really big one came a few years ago. But that was, I think, my first moment of clarity was that time. I sought out counsel to my dad at that point. And I remember I wasn't up two or three days that time when I went to talk to him. I had a clear mind. And we talked for a while. You know what? I had just a crazy idea. I had to get myself into a healthy environment quickly. Why? I don't know. And I went and talked to an Air Force recruiter We're talking going from one thing to another very quickly. As I say, I was a pretty good student in school. One thing I was always good at is remembering numbers and things. I was really good at that. And I test high on an AFAB test from the military. And they wanted me in the Air Force. And in 1985 is when I raised my right hand. Ronald Reagan was president. Pledge allegiance. And I was off to boot camp at Lackland Air Force Base, San Antonio, Texas. It was boot camp. Wasn't fun. But you know what? It wasn't anything like Marine for the Army. You know, this is kind of crazy. This is how I kind of break down the physical requirements of the different branches of service. For the Marines, you work out every day. Every day, you're working out. For most of the jobs, you're doing something 7 days a week, every day. In the Army, you're doing it 3, 4, 5 days a week, certain jobs. And there are certain minimum requirements you have to do. And the Navy, the next one in line, they have requirements. You have to do things twice a year. Twice a year. And the Air Force, once a year. So physical requirements really weren't that mandatory. And it was kind of funny. I was an athlete growing up. I was in pretty good shape physically. And they had their test, after basic training and all the stuff we did in basic training. Then I went to tech school in Colorado Springs. And then when I got to my first permanent station in New Mexico, Holloman Air Force Base, it was a TAC base with F-15 to F-16 fighters. And it's really cool. You know, after a while, you just get used to looking at this stuff every day. And if you're not used to seeing this stuff, it's really cool. And then I found out after I was there for a while, the annual physical thing was coming up. And I remember I was talking to my supervisor in our section, and there was a thing on the bulletin board about what the requirements were. I looked at it and I said, "Is this right?" And he said, "Yeah, why?" I said, "You mean all I have to do is run a mile and a half, and I have the option to walk it?" and they said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, shit." And I ran it. I even though I smoked cigarettes and the run was kind of, I remember the first time I did it, I ran a mile and a half in under 10 minutes. I remember a few years later, I think I had that under 9, which was pretty good for somebody that doesn't. But I played on a couple of base teams in sports. I played on a golf team on all three bases I was permanently at. I played on a two-squadron basketball teams. I played on a base fast-pitch softball team. I was a baseball player growing up. As I say, I was pretty good at certain things. In the 4.5, almost 5 years I was in the Air Force, I absolutely loved it. One thing it did do, it pretty much took those little side dishes I mentioned earlier, it kind of took those out of the equation. And the only thing left was alcohol. And I'm an Air Force base. Well, when I first went to tech school, we couldn't drink at basic at Lackland, but we can drink at tech school. And I started drinking there when I went to Holloman Air Force Base, New Mexico, my first base. I drank a lot. And it was kind of required. It was encouraged. I remember being at the NCO club with my first sergeant, just getting plastered, you know, and I had a motorcycle. I bought a bike when I was there. I wasn't there a week, when I bought a motorcycle. Just a putt-around base and going to Alamogordo, the little town there. I remember him and I were just drinking. I walked out of there, put my helmet on my head, drove two or three blocks to the dorm, made it there without killing myself. He knew all about it, but he was drunk himself. So, we did not have the fear of consequences on Air Force bases. And another thing the Air Force did not do, they did not teach me how not to drink. They taught me how to drink, but not to drink. And I think I already had a good head start on drinking before I even got there. Fell right on in. And the first time I ever felt anxiety from alcohol, the first time ever, was in my dorm room on a Saturday night party on that base when I ran out of tequila at around 11 o'clock at night. The on-base liquor store was closed. And we had nothing else to drink. And I felt the anxiety of running out of liquor. That was the first time. I always had other things to fall back on. I didn't have those other things anymore. So I learned a valuable lesson that night. And the valuable lesson is have an extra bottle of tequila left, which I did. And I was at that base for 2.5 years. I went there to Kunsan, South Korea. I was there for a year. And before I even left New Mexico, I had it arranged that I was going to Germany after Korea. Because I had 6 months left in when after I did my 1 year tour, and they could send me anywhere in the world for 6 months. And that scared the hell out of me. I can just imagine myself in Minot, North Dakota, or Elmendorf, Alaska, or something like that. And I said, there's no way in hell I'm going to arrange this. And I got orders to go to Germany after Korea. And Korea was fun. A lot of stuff to do in Korea. Played on the base golf team. We traveled around a little bit. That was fun. Did a lot of drinking. That was fun. Other things were fun. We had a good time. Leave it at that. Now, Germany was another big story, too. The German beer they all know of, it's there. And there's a lot of it. Every town has a brewery. Almost every little... There's 500 breweries in Germany. Almost every town of any size is going to have their own hometown brewery. And I was stationed at Bitburg Air Force Base. And we had the brand called Bitburger. And it was really good. And drank a lot of it. And you can even see it in some stores even today. I did all that without even reading anything off my page. I'm kind of proud of that, actually. I got out in the latter part of 1989. Stayed in Florida for a little while. My parents sold their house in Dunwoody and moved to Sarasota, Florida. My dad retired. And that's kind of cool. Back in, you know, in those days, he worked for the same company for 36 years. GE Credit Corporation hired him right out of college. Only job he ever had. And that's when they were taking care of their people, that they're some of their execs. And my folks were very comfortable in retirement. And it was always a nice place to go on vacation, so down to Sarasota, Florida. I went down when I got out of the service. They were already moved. I went there, stayed there for a couple of months, and I came back up to Atlanta and started working. I tried to get on at Lockheed. They were not hiring. They had a hiring freeze at the time, and that kind of discouraged me a little bit. I was hanging out with some of my buddies, and some of my buddies were making a pretty good bit of money selling retail. And they worked at one of my best friends, Tim, worked at Roberts in Norcross, corner of 85 and Jimmy Carter, big store there for many years. And when I walked in, they hired me on the spot. And I worked for that company for over 11 years. I did quite well. I found out that I was good at other things too. I was good at talking. I was good at getting people to buy stuff. And back then, we could make a really good living doing that. Did a lot of partying. That's where my friend Harry, I mentioned him earlier. That's where I met him. I was going to tell a story about him and I, but I don't think I will. I think I'll pass on that one. I did a lot of partying with and without this gentleman. I met a nice lady there that worked with me. Very nice lady, and we actually got married. And that was in 1993. My now ex-wife, Gail, she came from a family of hard drinkers, Irish girl from Boston, and they had a chain of furniture stores when they moved. When she grew up in Virginia Beach, they had a chain of furniture stores in Virginia Beach. So this is something she did her whole life. Her dad had those four stores, catered to a lot of naval guys. Very, very successful little four-store chain there. She had three brothers. They all worked in the business. And to say, she came from a hardcore line of drinkers. Her dad was a hardcore alcoholic. I never met him. He dropped dead of a heart attack at 50 years old. And when he did, you know, he had those four stores. Gail's mom ran one. Gail had one. And the brothers had one each. And one brother, I don't think, was employable. So, drinking too much. But you know what? One brother moved down here. And how I got to know him, when he moved down here, he got a job at Roberts where I was working. And the rest of the family followed. And that's how I got to know him. And I met Gail. And we dated for a little while and we got married. I remember one day she told me. And keep in mind, she came from a line of hardcore drinkers. And one night we were having a few. And she looked at me and she says, you know, I've never seen anybody drink like you. I said, dang it. That hurts. That stung. Because I know the people you've seen drinking. I mean, gosh. I didn't think I was that bad of a drinker, but obviously I was. We stayed married. We, you know, her and I, we worked together. We both did well. We didn't have, our daughter came along a few years later, but you know what? We had nice things. We took nice vacations. Had some toys, boat, had a bike, had some nice things. And then our daughter came along in 1997. I was right there in scrubs, cut the cord, held her. First thing she ever looked at when she opened her eyes. And I thought, man, this is it. For about 6 months. Then I started drinking again. Even the birth of my daughter and the love in her eyes was not going to change the way that I am. I was so used to doing things my own way. And about 6 months later, in the summer of 97, is when I made my way the first time to this very room right here, and I sat right over here. And it was 11 o'clock meeting. I'm guessing probably June of 97. And I was sitting right over there, 11 o'clock meeting. And I talked. Some people come up and consoled me afterwards. I'm sure the ones that really knew about character defects and stuff knew I was totally full of shit. And this was on a Thursday. And I came back that night for the men's group. The famous NABA men's group on Thursday night. And when I walked in here, all these old guys were smiling, having a good old time, patting each other on the back. And I'm thinking to myself, there's no way these guys are anything like me to be this damn happy. And there was another young, and hell, I was in my mid-30s. I mean, I wasn't a young guy, but there was a young guy in here, and he was here for his very first meeting. And he introduced himself, the chairperson asked if there was anybody here new, and he raised his hand. And not long after the meeting started, he raised his hand to share. He didn't get a chance to. The old guy says, "Shut the hell up, you have nothing for us to hear. You just sit down and listen." And I went, gosh damn. And that was 29 years ago in this room right here. That's when, I mean, have you ever heard stories about the old men's meeting in this room back then? These old guys here at NABA. Normally the guys were the mafia on the wall right over here. And that's where they sat. It was on that wall right over there. But there were a bunch of them. There weren't just five or six of them. There were a bunch of them in this room that night. And scared the hell out of me. I didn't say a word. I just sat over there, not even a peep. I mind my own business. But I did manage to talk to somebody after the meeting. And keep in mind, my dad was an alcoholic, so I'm not really unfamiliar. I'm still fairly familiar with this. I got divorced a while. I moved out, lived alone, isolation. Got me a nice little apartment over in Duluth. My daughter was 3 years old. My ex-wife would drop her off on her way to work. I stayed there almost 2 years. Right at 9/11, when 9/11 happened, that Tuesday morning, 9/11, 2001, I think most of us may remember that morning. I was watching it on TV, freaked out. I was working for Bill Hurd Chevrolet in Buford. I remember I went to work very late that day, like everybody did, and it was like the whole world just changed for some reason. I had a strong desire to get out of Atlanta. The very next day when I came in, I walked in my GM's office. I said, I had vacation time coming. I want to take vacation. And I had a friend of mine in Louisiana who had been trying to get me to come work for him. Him and his brother bought a little Ford dealership in the town they grew up in. I called Greg up and I asked him, hey, I want to come. I'm going to take a drive out there. I'm going to come visit you. And I did. And it was a quaint little town. And I knew his wife. He had five kids. Big, nice house in town. And Greg was a lover of Canadian whiskey like I was. I already knew that ahead of time. And Cynthia's wife was a UGA grad, and when they lived here, I got to know her pretty well. When I was there, when Sissy came up to me, he said, Jeff, if you consider moving here, something I just want you to understand. This is a small town. Everybody knows each other. Everybody knows what everybody else does. You sure you want to move here? And I wanted to get out of town, and I did. I moved there. I ran a Ford store for my friend, and we had a lot of drinking binges together, him and I, and I stayed there for a year. And I promised him a year, and I stayed a year. One thing I've always kind of been important Things always been important to me is do what I say I'm going to do. And I promised him a year, and I stayed a year. My dad was getting sick. I packed my stuff up, and I went to Florida. Then I came back up here a few months later, and that was the summer of 2003. That's when I came up here. And that's when I started to frequent this clubhouse a lot more. That's when I got a sponsor. And I'm going to share something kind of funny about, I was doing step work with my sponsor, who's actually at the time, he's here tonight. We were doing step work downstairs. We were doing step three in the cafeteria. And there were some other people down there too. And back then there was a little niche over in the corner that had vending machines. And we were doing the third step, and it was time for us to do the third step prayer. I had it written down, but I'm not going to read it. So we did, you know, the third, of course, you know, God, offer myself to thee. And, you know, we did the third step prayer. We got on my knees, you know, closed my eyes, and got it done. Opened my eyes. I said, amen. Opened my eyes. And I'm looking at a bag of Cheetos in the vending machine. And every time I think, whenever I hear the third step prayer, I think of a bag of Cheetos. As crazy as that might sound, but it's true. It still do. I think of a bag of Cheetos. I don't know if you remember that or not. He's over shaking. He's over nodding his head. You know, I'm going to fast forward a bit. I did want to go through the steps here pretty quickly too, and how they apply to me. And I was in and out. I was in and out for quite a while. I had some years of sobriety. 2017, I had a bad relapse. And I was in and out. Had a great relationship with a nice lady for almost 5 years. And my behaviors ruined that. There was a lot of shame, a lot of guilt involved. And all that did was keep me out longer, pretty much what it did. And I'm gonna jump up to 2023. I had a townhouse not too far from here, and the owner of the townhouse was selling it. I was renting it from him, and actually I was renting it from his brother, who wasn't even living here in Georgia. But I had it at a great price, and the new buyers didn't want me there anymore because they knew they could make a hell of a lot more money on it from somebody else. This was in 2023. And I moved out, and that was January 23rd of 2023. And if you recall what date my sobriety date was, it was the very next day. I was extremely sick. There were 18 stairs going up to my bedroom upstairs at that townhouse. It took me 3 or 4 times to go up those stairs to catch my breath just to make it up 18 stairs. And if I was carrying a bag of something, it took longer. I was so sick. When I went to the on the day before, on the 23rd, I had a moment of clarity. That other moment of clarity that I had earlier, this was the big one. And I went to Northside Hospital, Gwinnett, walked in the emergency room, pretty busy that night. And it was Saturday night. I walked in, and almost instantly they took me to the back. I had chest pains. And they put me in a room, and I was very sick. When I walked in there, I weighed 130 pounds. Size 30 weights was falling off of me, and I was bigger when I was 13 years old than I was at 61 at that time. 61 and a half. Okay. Are we too old to ever say halves anymore? Okay. 61 and a half. I was very sick. I called my daughter. I hadn't talked to my daughter. My daughter worked for a big church in Gwinnett County. I hadn't talked to my daughter in a year and a half. I didn't want her to see me. She didn't want to see me. And I sure as hell didn't want her to see me using the way I was. And really what I kind of turned into at that point. But she was very happy to hear from me. So we talked a few more times. And they had a procedure, doing a procedure on me on April 2nd. On February 2nd, during that procedure, my breathing stopped and my heart stopped. And I was technically dead for about 30 seconds. They went into code blue mode and got me back to life. And they called my daughter and said, you better come see your dad. And she came right away. My ex-wife, Gail, I love her for it. She brought my daughter that night. My daughter, I was telling this earlier. My daughter's a pastor at a big church in Gwinnett County. And she was at that time. She just graduated Indiana Wesleyan, and she just got on staff at where she's still working now. She had a curiosity, and when she walked in that room, I was in ICU. When she walked in the ICU room, she walked up to me, and here I am. Look, I must have looked like like death. And, you know, it's not like, Dad, I'm so glad to see you. Dad, how you doing? It wasn't any of that. She walked up and whispered in my ear, Dad, what did you see? You know, and I said, you know, that's one of the old most mysteries of all time, is what does somebody see when they die? You know, I didn't see anything. Yeah, I didn't see anything. I didn't want to disappoint her about that, you know. I kind of did. I didn't. Instead, I was kind of pissed off that she wasn't all, Dad, I'm so glad. No, what, none of that. Dad, what'd you see? And I didn't see any pearly gates, no white lights or anything like that. I remember, but I do remember that something bad happened. I remember that part. So my brain was active enough while my heart was stopped to know something not right was going on. So I guess if I'd have stayed dead a little longer, you know, I might have saw some neon lights or something, who knows. But I didn't. I'm not going to take the chance. Jails, institutions, and death. I've been to all three. Thank you very much. Most people haven't been to all three. They stop at the first two. They don't get to the third one very often. But I did. You know what? The first step, admitted our powers over my addiction, and my life is unmanageable. Step one. It's what it takes to get in this, to bring us, to carry your ass into this room, into these rooms, and sit in a chair. Okay? I did my step one with my moment of clarity to get to the hospital on the 23rd of January. That was my step one. And step two, I think, was when they brought me back to life and my daughter came in and something came over me that day, that night. What came over me was, I cannot do this alone. That's what came over me. Step two. And when I went to church yesterday morning, and the main message, the theme of yesterday, it's Easter, the theme is, what do I do when my power is not enough? And cool, there's a lot of times in church you hear a lot of recovery type stuff. And if that's not step two recovery shit, I don't know what is. Really. My power is not enough. I know I cannot do it by myself. I know I can't. I need help. And that comes with a group of people like you guys. Yeah, it comes with a sponsor. It comes with a higher power. It comes with just letting somebody else drive for a while, because I've proved to myself I cannot drive myself very well. Okay, my life is going to be unmanageable. Step three, I've already talked about step three. I think of Cheetos. Okay, so I'm going to bring it past that one. Step four is, I need to find out what makes me tick. Okay, liquor, cocaine, weed, meth, all this shit, man. It's just, these are all just symptoms of who I am, of what I've created. And it's like a pacifier. When I don't want to feel feelings, when I don't want to feel emotions, when I don't want to feel shame or guilt, I don't want to feel shit. I just want to just float away somewhere. Okay? And maybe just isolate and not feel anything. I need a mask. I need to put something over my face where I can't feel this stuff. And that's what I use all these other things for. But there's an underlying reason for all this. I need to kind of find out why. And these character defects, I found out what they are. These character defects are something that it took me decades to cultivate these character defects. Okay? And some of them I kind of liked. You know, I didn't want to give some of them up. I worked the steps with a competent sponsor. And this time around, I have a sponsor here in the room as well. And very proud to be a sponsor these days. They may think, I have two sponsors currently. And one of the sponsors has four sponsors, so I'm a grand sponsor now. That's some scary shit there. And you know what? I got the, you know, I'm thinking that they think that I'm helping them. Fine, they can think that all they want. That's cool. But you know what? They're helping me more than I'm helping them. Okay? That's what this thing is all about. And learned this in a meeting the other day, that some of Dr. Bob's last words he ever said was two words, love and service. I heard that in our home group the other day by Willis. And I thought that was pretty cool. And that's what we do, man. That's what we do. And I have to learn to love myself before I can try to help or love anybody else. Yeah, like on 4 and 5 and 8 and 9, You know, the common denominator there was me. I had all the resentments. I created most of the shit in my own head, you know, and I had to make amends to myself in 8 and 9 before I can make amends to anybody else. That's how it works. Okay? So I guess I'm just going to go ahead and wrap this stuff up. If you're new to AA, just keep coming back, please. It gets better. It does. It gets better. Early sobriety definitely sucks. I assure you, hang around for a while and work the steps with a sponsor. You will just all of a sudden wake up one day and think, damn, I feel better than I did yesterday. And it's kind of cool how that happens. It does happen that way. I feel better. Whether you have a higher power, whether it's a group of people in a room, and how I like to say it, I think more for me, my higher power speaks to me through other people. Big time. I've got some people in my corner, quite a few of them are here tonight. I have an open mind. If I ask them, I need some advice. What do you think? Let me run something by you, and what do you think? I don't want to think I already have a predetermined idea of what I'm going to do. Some things I do. I just want a little validation now and again. That's one of my character defects. I could pull it out now and again and use it. I like a little validation sometimes, but then again, I always want to keep an open mind and just step two, restore me to sanity. I've been insane. I've done some crazy shit in my life, and to think I was ever sane is I'm done. Thank you very much for letting me share. Thank you.
First I slip, and then I quit to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul. Take me where the promise is.